being able to walk beside these kids as they figure out what they want and what they need. Like that is, I was talking to a friend about helping trans people with mental health issues who are in like a group home situation and how to navigate that. And I'm like, honestly, what they need is an advocate and not a set of prescribed principles, because what one person needs isn't necessarily what another person needs. And we're not always aware of what we need unless we have someone to kind of say, okay, in this situation, you know, what do you think you would want? Here are some options. And you know, it's just so beautifully complicated and diverse. And I love it because I can think about it for days and hours and still not know and have more questions than I do answers, but in this profoundly beautiful way.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Mason, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. You are one of a long line of many people who have been referred to us by our mutual friend and former podcast guest, Sarah Peck. And every time she refers somebody, I don't even read their bio. I just say yes because of the fact somehow she seems to have a knack for constantly sending us amazing people. So I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school, and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
So I grew up in an extremely rural school. Like my entire high school had 250 people, graduating class of 60. So we were all kind of in the same social group, but I was in this little subset of nerds and really conservative Christian nerds is the aspect that I, the space that I took up in high school. And it's almost baffling looking back on me in high school versus where I am now, because I was very much in the closet and now I'm very much out. And I was very much, I was very much the same person, but very different from where I am now. And it's almost baffling to look at my journey from then to now and make sense of it. That's something that I've really kind of still have moments where I'm like, oh yeah, I was that Bible thumper kid at church five times a week and going to Bible study after school. Right. That was a part of my life. and you know, it's really shaped getting here, and like being from a rural community is almost more salient than like the social group I was part of, because you know, when you have 66 kids in your graduating class, you're all in the same social group. It's just subsets.
Mm-hmm. So navigating that duality of the same time being in the closet and also surrounded by sort of Bible thumping religious Christian, I mean, and what is that like, and how do you deal with the fact that you have these two parts of your identity going on, particularly at that age?
You know, at that age, I was so deep in the closet. Like my big joke is that I was so far in the closet, I think I found Narnia. But I had no idea. Like I didn't even know I was in the closet. I thought that, you know, I just wasn't, like I was able to hide my sexuality within conservative Christianity because it wasn't that I wasn't attracted to men. It was that I wasn't attracted to any of the men in my small community because they weren't godly enough. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't even realize like that I was attracted to women until I was 19 and had gone off to college and lived a little life. And then I was like, oh, I don't actually just really respect her. I that's a crush. Okay. And like this big awakening moment was like, oh my God, I want to hold her. And it's not platonic. And then I panicked and like ran as deep into the closet as I could yet again. But this time I knew, and I hated myself for years, and like massive mental health issues in and out of the psychiatric ward with self-harm and suicidal thoughts. And until I finally came out at 23. So like it's been an interesting journey.
Tell me about the experience of coming out. One, who do you tell at first? Are there people who probably already knew? What is the you know reaction from your own parents and family like, and particularly given the community that you grew up in?
It's been interesting. I mean, coming out is something that never ends. At this point, I don't have to use words to come out most of the time. People look at me and go, yep, gay. But when I first came out, I was terrified. I came out to my cousin first because I knew that she would be a super safe person to come out to. And then just kind of slowly started telling more and more people. I told my younger sister and she was supportive. I told close friends and they were supportive. And I just kept on expanding this circle of authenticity and telling people who I am and revealing this part of myself. And, you know, I mean, my parents, it's been an interesting journey with them. I told my mom in a therapy appointment because I was too scared to tell her otherwise. And she was like, "What makes you think that I wouldn't be supportive?" And I was like, It's little things that made me doubt, you know, and just little comments here and there that filled me with doubt that you would be there. And, you know, she has turned out to be an amazing supporter. She is, you know, unfamiliar and a little uncomfortable, I think, but she lives in rural Missouri and it is this unfamiliar, you know, she just doesn't know and doesn't want to screw up. So it's awkward, but like, she loves the shit out of me. She loves the shit out of my daughter and the shit out of my wife. And like, okay, cool. And then my dad is like this stereotypical Midwestern farmer, who doesn't talk a whole lot. And so like the story of like, I came out to my dad and it was like, yep. And that was the conversation, but then that was it. And I was like, cool. But then the moment I realized that my dad was completely cool was we actually, neither of us had ever been to Hooters and there was one that was close to where I was living. And, you know, he asked me where we should get dinner. And I just kind of listed all the restaurants and like half jokingly included Hooters. And he was like, you know, I've never been there. I was like, I haven't either. So my dad and I went to Hooters together. And as we were leaving, he was like, you know, I could never take your mom or sisters anywhere like this. And like, that was the moment where I was like, oh, my dad's totally cool. And like, just that moment of realization was really powerful. And then one of the last people I told was my older sister, who at that point, I think, had 3 kids. And she cut me out of her life for 6 months and didn't let me be a part of her life until we had this tenuous don't ask, don't tell relationship for about 5 or 6 years. And then our younger sister passed away from ovarian cancer 4 years ago. And we tried to mend our relationship at that point, but I told her that I was going to marry my wife and she requested no more communication after that. And so I've seen her 3 times in the past 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you realized you were gay, what are the questions that you're wrestling with about what this could mean for your life? What are the things that you were afraid of? And what are the kinds of questions you think that parents or your parents were thinking when you told them or asking themselves about this?
It was a huge identity shift for me because my faith had been the background and the like salient factor in my life for so long. And all of a sudden, it isn't that it was taken away from me. It was that it shifted because this world that I was very comfortable in and felt very safe in all of a sudden wasn't safe. When I came out, I was excommunicated from the church that I was a member of and, you know, told that I wasn't welcome in their doors ever again. And that shook me to the core. And so I had to like go through this rediscovery of who I am at 23. And, you know, I feel like now at 33, 10 years out of the closet, I've really only in the past 2 or 3 years started to come into my own. Because it's almost like, you know, going through a second adolescence where I was like, oh, right. This is who I am. This is like the unchangeable intrinsic parts of who I am. And these haven't changed. I just have different words and definitions for them.
What are the experiences that you've had over the last couple of years that have cemented this identity more, or made this foundation that this identity is stronger for you?
You know, it's my story is that I came out as being gay, and then I came out as genderqueer, which is kind of a whole extra level of, you know, being in this space where I don't really identify as female, but I don't really identify as male. I'm just kind of somewhere in this gray area in between the two. And so kind of navigating that, and really a lot of therapy and a lot of soul searching has been really good. And, you know, a lot of the identity shift has more to do with my mental health issues than coming out in some ways. Because the first job that I held down for longer than like 2 years or longer than a year was at a textbook warehouse here in town. And I literally for 8 hours picked textbooks off of shelves and put them into boxes to be shipped. And that was my job. And it was exactly what I needed at that point, because I knew exactly what I was expecting as I walked in the doors every day. I knew exactly what would happen. If I didn't want to talk to anybody, I didn't have to. And, you know, I got exercise, which, you know, is super good for mental health. And I learned that maybe I could be a responsible adult. Maybe I could do this. And that was like super foundational for me. And then when I met my wife 5 years ago, seeing how she loves me and how she sees me authentically has really helped me come into my own and learn how to advocate for myself and to say, no, actually, I use they, other than pronouns, and I am going to have that difficult conversation when people use the wrong words for me. And to really kind of realize this is who I am. And then kind of the final step in that is through my wife, I started working with the LGBT teen group here in my town, and seeing teenagers who, you know, were 13 and coming out and navigating school and parents and life at such a young age has just really profoundly impacted the way I want to show up and the way that I want to live my life, because I know that these kids are looking at me as an example. And so do I let myself get mired down in the bullshit that my bipolar brain tells me, or do I work my ass off to rise above? Well, I'm going to work my butt off. Like, I'm going to make this happen because I want those kids to see that they have a future.
Mm-hmm. What are the challenges? I mean, we've talked a bit about the challenges that you face navigating the relationship and social dynamics, but what about life in general? I had another transgender person here, Ray Singari, who talked about, you know, being a transgender artist and you know, the job, you know, the job search, the professional areas, like there are a whole set of challenges that I think most of us are completely unaware of. And I wonder if you could shed some more light on that for me.
Yeah. When I started discovering gender identity, it was just like a whole new world of fears and questions and excitement. You know, I mean, I got my bachelor's degree. My goal was before I was 30, and I got it at 28 and a half. So, you know, check that box. And after that, I didn't know what to do with myself. And, you know, I ended up getting a job making coffee, and 4.5 years later, here I am, because the company that I work with is so incredibly inclusive. Like, before my name was legally changed to Mason, they instated systems where every store, like if I were to go to another store to use my discount, Mason would show up and not my birth name. And you know what? That keeps me there, and that kept me there. And, you know, the struggle of like, how do I apply for a job? What do I do before my name was legally changed? What do I put on a resume? How do I talk about my pronouns? Do I even have that conversation? When do I have that conversation? You know, and I mean, I'm lucky to be in a progressive college town, you know, in Missouri, where there is a non-discrimination policy in place on the city level. But, you know, if I were to want to go to Jefferson City to get a job, they could fire me, with the only reason being that I'm trans. And you know, that has in some ways created this desire to strike out on my own and have my own business instead of working for someone else, in part because of those fears of having to navigate work life. And, you know, will people freak out if I'm wearing a shirt and tie? You know, how do I, you know, navigate other people's reactions and the systems in place that just, you know, like before my wife and I were able to get legally married, what would we do? And you know, now that we have a kid, there's like, now that we're able to be legally married, that kind of solves a lot of those things. But, you know, the threat of being fired for being who I am, all like even still hangs over my head, even though I'm in a city that where that's a legally protected class.
Mm. What do you think has to happen in terms of policy or social structure in order for this to be more acceptable and to make life more manageable for trans people like yourself? Like, what are the things that people in power need to do about this?
You know, a lot of the changes are relatively small that have a huge impact. Man, you know, if I see somebody's intake forms or application has a pronouns line on it, I'm there. Like, that's like a little happy dance. Or like seeing pronoun lines in email signatures is another thing that just makes me go, yes. And you know, I think the first step is just having these conversations. You know, having conversations with trans people about their experiences in the workplace, having conversations about what challenges, you know, they have faced, because everybody's experiences are different. And you know, the challenges that I face are very different than what other people face. But, you know, working in retail, I get called ma'am about 20,000 times a day, it feels like. And every time it's like, you know, water torture, like a drip of water on your forehead, that when it happens once, it's like, oh, well, that was mildly inconvenient. But when it's every day, all day, it just is like, ugh, the worst. And, you know, I think educating people and starting to have the conversation is step number one. And you know, then let's move into, you know, pronoun lines on forms and changing language on websites and having inclusive healthcare and providing benefits to domestic partners. And, you know, all of those little things, like fertility isn't covered by most companies' insurance. And so, you know, to have our daughter, we paid approximately $5,000 to get my wife pregnant. And, you know, that's even for people without a uterus to grow a baby, it's even more expensive and even more complicated. And you know, people should be able to have families and should have their employers supporting their families. And you know, just those things that, you know, we don't always think about. Like, as people in privilege, myself included, you know, not necessarily on the trans aspect, but on other aspects, like, I am so unaware because I am simply oblivious. I don't have to think about things. And, you know, if we sit down and have conversations and learn, like, that's huge to be able to help navigate, you know, these potentially tricky waters, like gender neutral bathrooms. How do we do that? You know, if it's a single stall bathroom, it should be gender neutral. Like, I see absolutely no reason not to have a gender neutral single stall bathroom. If it's multi-stall, yeah, it's nuanced and complicated. And, you know, there are no cut and dry answers for that sort of situation. In my mind, I think that it's very much variable on, you know, who your audience is and what stand you want to take. And, you know, take a stand. do something. That's what matters, is to do something.
Hey, it's Srini. I want to tell you about a really cool new app that I recently discovered that I think you'll find really valuable and really like. It's called Reason8.ai, and it's a note-taking app for meetings. If you have in-person meetings, you'll dig this app because it records your entire meeting, gives you a full transcript, and it gives you a summary and action items. So that way you can be more present during your meetings and you don't have to sit around taking notes. It's something that we use in every one of our meetings now, and it's been invaluable to our meetings to be able to go back and review them. Not only does it give you the transcript, a summary, and action items, it also gives you a full recording of the meeting so you can go back and you can play it if you want to check it out. So visit reason8.ai and download the app today. Again, that's reason8.ai. So you mentioned that you work with teenagers, you know, around LGBT issues and coming out. And being a teenager is such a mindfuck of a situation as it is, right? Like, I don't think anybody looks at being a teenager and thinks, yeah, that was one of the greatest times of my life. Like, all I remember is I fought with my parents. I thought they were the most awful people in the world. And, you know, my voice was changing and I didn't understand why my hormones were out of control. If I layered a gender identity crisis on top of that, I don't know how I would handle it. So I wonder, one, you know, how do you guide people through this process? What are the unique challenges, particularly when they're dealing with this at that age, because that age is so complicated as it is?
It's really interesting though, because you look at today's teens have so much access to knowledge and information that I didn't when I was in high school, because, you know, by the powers of the internet. And, you know, it's amazing how self-aware and well-educated these teenagers are on aspects of identity and who they are and how they want to show up in the world. And what I find to be the biggest challenges that they face are not so much internally as externally. It's, you know, how do I talk to my siblings about this? How do I talk to my parents about this? You know, how do I navigate the school system? You know, where so often, you know, we're separated boys and girls. And, you know, what do I do about PE? What do I do about all of these situations? And you know, being able to walk beside these kids as they figure out what they want and what they need. Like, that is, I was talking to a friend about helping trans people with mental health issues who are in like a group home situation and how to navigate that. And I'm like, honestly, what they need is an advocate and not a set of prescribed principles, because what one person needs isn't necessarily what another person needs. And we're not always aware of what we need unless we have someone to kind of say, okay, in this situation, you know, what do you think you would want? Here are some options. And you know, it's just so beautifully complicated and diverse. And I love it, because I can think about it for days and hours and still not know and have more questions than I do answers, but in this profoundly beautiful way.
What are school systems doing to handle this? Because I don't imagine this is, you know, isolated to one school district or anything like that. So I mean, what are people in our education system doing to navigate this dynamic?
There are more and more gender neutral bathrooms are showing up in our schools, which is amazing. And you know, it depends on where the school is located, what they are able and willing to do. You know, here in Missouri, I've worked with a couple of rural schools who are like, here's what we can do, but there's not really much else we can, you know, because there would be such an uproar. And like, I understand that, but man, it sucks. And you know, I mean, I feel like having some sort of non-discrimination act, you know, policy in place is a huge step. Especially like our city school district has a non-discrimination policy in place for employees. And so I have a friend who is agender, asexual, and aromantic. And it is a teacher in the school district and has had nothing but amazing support from its principal on the elementary school level. So like, the principal has fielded all of the parent conversations, and that's just been really cool to see how it's played out and the support that this person has had as an employee, and knowing that, you know, these kids have a positive role model, someone who maybe looks like them that they didn't know otherwise. And, you know, that's where I really see that schools can step up, is in supporting their LGBT teachers and staff and in educating their teachers. You know, educating as to like why it's important to, you know, call roll by saying, hey, will you introduce yourself, instead of saying names, you know. And like, the name issue is one that I recently like had this realization that, you know, asking people for what name they go by instead of using the legal one on the roster doesn't just impact trans students. It impacts students who might have trauma associated with a name or who just go by a nickname, even as simple as that, you know. Like, though, it's the implications of some of these changes go beyond just the LGBT community, and kind of realizing that has been eye-opening for me.
Hmm. So you mentioned that you have a daughter, yeah. And I wonder about the experience of being, you know, trans and raising kids. What is it like? And then, you know, what is it like for your daughter as well?
She is 18 months old now. So, you know, she's kind of in that space where, you know, me being who I am and her having two parents who the world views as female, they're like, she obviously doesn't give two fucks. It's her mama and Maymay, whatever. But you know, we've been really lucky in that we have a daycare that has been amazing and super supportive of our family. But I have had this really interesting like insight of seeing the double standard of parenting for moms versus dads in this super intimate way where, you know, as a masculine person, I am treated more like a dad would be. And like, people are amazed when I show up and I'm on the parents committee at school, or when I, you know, solo parent and take care of our kiddo for 5 days while my wife went on a trip. And like there was at one point, when she was really young, like 6 months old, and I was exhausted at work that day. And one of my coworkers was like, "Wow, you were up with a baby all night. That's amazing." And I was like, "Why is that amazing? Like, I don't get it." But at the same time, we do have this double standard of what is expected of moms versus what is expected of dads. Like, the amount of mom guilt that my wife experiences is very different from what I experience. And like, seeing her navigate parenting alongside me as a feminine person who identifies as a woman, like her guilt and shame and her perceptions and cares about what other people think about her is so vastly different from mine. And just kind of seeing that has been really interesting and has shifted the way that I view parenting and parents, and has opened up a lot of thoughts and conversations around what does masculinity look like and mean to me as someone who was assigned female at birth, someone who was socialized female. What does it mean to be a masculine person?
What, if any, have been uncomfortable or awkward or difficult moments in situations with other people who've seen you and your wife together and interacted with your family? Have you had situations that you feel like judgment is being passed on you? And what are those, and how do you navigate those?
We luckily haven't had too many. You know, it's always real weird when we're asked if we're sisters. No. But the main one is we went to a doctor's appointment together when Bug was sick, and the doctor asked us who was the real mom. And it was like, we're both her parents. Like, there is no real mom. Yes, my wife carried her, and no, she doesn't share my DNA, but that's not what makes a parent. And it was just, it's the one big moment where we were like, what the fuck? No. And beyond that, there haven't been too many beyond awkward stares, which at this point in my life are just par for the course.
So your daughter is 18 months old, which, you know, at this point, like you said, she's probably not even really aware of the situation. She just has two people who love and care for her, which at 18 months is, you know, what you probably need. But as she gets older, she is probably going to become aware of the fact that she's in a situation that's different from, you know, the people that she's friends with, the people that she goes to school with. How do you plan on navigating that dynamic? What challenges do you anticipate? And, you know, what do you think that whole experience is going to be like by the time she reaches an age where she is able to understand what's going on?
I am more worried about other parents than I am about her peers. You know, I mean, kids don't give a shit until they're taught to, you know, about who's in her, you know. And we plan on telling her from a very early age, even starting now, that, you know, there are all different kinds of families. Some kids have two moms, some kids have two dads, some kids have a mom and a dad, some kids live with their grandparents, and that family is family, and that's what matters. But at the same time, I'm like, how do I have these conversations about like in-depth gender theory and, you know, what non-binary gender means, and seeing me authentically when the world doesn't, because, you know, society just isn't quite there yet. Like, I'm not entirely sure, you know, how we're going to have those conversations and how we're going to navigate that. But, you know, I also look at, you know, the teenagers that I have worked with and the teenagers in my life and, you know, just, and looking at my generation and the people who, you know, are my age and just how much further we've come and how much better people want to do. And, you know, I just think people need to know, and people just don't know and are afraid to ask. And, you know, ask. That's how you learn. Find a safe person to ask. Don't expect everybody to do emotional labor on your behalf. But like, for me, ask me, please. Let me talk about this stuff. I love it.
You know, when I heard you talk about that, I was watching an episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and it was about school segregation, which you didn't think, okay, we live in, you know, 2018, seriously, like there's school segregation. And it turns out it's actually quite common, more than we think. And, you know, just based on policy and design, schools are segregated, not based on law, but because of policy. And they show this clip of a psychologist, a mom, and a really, really young girl, like maybe 2 or 3 years old or whatever, you know, super, super young. And she had gone to a school where she had only ever seen white kids. And the psychologist had her point to various, she had a picture of all these babies, and she said, which ones are the good ones? Which one is the bad one? And she actually pointed to the black baby. Mm. And, you know, and the mom was just horrified. And what the psychologist said is, this is what happens when kids don't get exposed to people that don't look like them or don't appear like them, or they don't, it's just a lack of exposure creates this bias, you know, unintentionally. And it makes me think that, you know, I think that the reality is that the more that kids are exposed to families like yours, the more that it won't become something to see as abnormal, but okay, yeah, this is totally normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's where, like, you know, I'm lucky that we live in a diverse community, where there are a lot of LGBT families, and where I know my daughter will see kids with families like hers. And you know, that's when, If you have a kid and you're in this position, like, books are huge when it comes to exposure if you don't have those people in your life. I mean, I grew up in a community that's 98% white. You know, I was not exposed, and I am still working on bias over race, just that was ingrained with me by lack of knowledge. But reading to your kids and reading books that have LGBT families, even if you don't explicitly talk about it, like, that has huge power, to read these books where it's like, oh, and look, you know, this baby has two mommies. And like, kids get it at a young age when they see it. But you're right, they have to see it.
Hmm. So I guess where I want to finish with is by talking about the role that media and culture and popular culture. I mean, you mentioned books. What role does that play in, and what is the role of media in helping us raise awareness of the things that you and I are talking about?
It's massive. I mean, I am not a huge media consumer myself. I tend to be in the podcast audiobook world, but like, seeing people like me portrayed in a positive light, even now, like, is the most exciting thing in the world. And you know, for kids and for teens, you know, whether they're LGBTQ or not, to see families that look like mine, I mean, maybe they won't be the ones staring at us. Maybe they won't be, you know, maybe if your kid sees people who appear more androgynous, they won't be the one in the grocery store screaming, "Mommy, is that a boy or a girl?" Which is totally developmentally appropriate if that happens. But, you know, exposure through media, through popular culture, through just the ability to have those conversations, you know, is so powerful. Because, you know, we can't always control the community we live in and how diverse it is, but we can, you know, have a say in what we consume and what we watch and where we put our attention and our energy. And I think it's all about being intentional in, you know, educating ourselves and look seeking diversity.
Wow. Well, this has been really, really thought-provoking and eye-opening and insightful, as I expected it would be. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Authenticity. We are all so insanely, beautifully, wonderfully diverse and unique. Own it, man. Own it.
Awesome. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
The two places that you can find me most often are themasonaid.com and @MasonAid on Instagram.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.